This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to the program, which is, as we tally it up, the fourth to the last program we're going to do before Election Day. Based upon the fact that we're looking at Wednesdays as being the day of posting this show. Based on the fact that we broadcast at 8 a.m. on Wednesday mornings from KDVS Davis, 90.3 FM. Though we certainly know that a lot of you are listening courtesy of our website at radioparallax.com. We hope on next week's program to bring back Stephen J. Harper, always an excellent guest. At which point we will delve into his September 28th, 2024 posting on commondreams.org, article titled, How Trump is Already Trying to Rig the 2024 Election. We will hopefully have that for you on next week's program. For this week's program, we're going to take a look at something that you all should be aware of, which is that movie, The Apprentice, will be hitting theaters this weekend. And Mr. Miller and I are certainly planning to attend a showing somewhere, and I can't tell you where it'll be showing. We'll have to figure that out on our own. But later on in this segment, we're going to take a look at our version of The Apprentice, which would be, the link between the notorious lawyer Roy Cohn and Donald J. Trump, who, by any standard, was Roy Cohn's apprentice back in the 70s. The two remained close up till Cohn's death in the late 80s. But before we go down that road, I want to do some of the usual things that we have traditionally done on this program, which is, talk a bit about current events and alert you to things maybe you should know about. And in the latter category, we have the comet, which is whipping around the sun as we speak, and by the weekend might be putting on quite a spectacular show in the sky. There's a great warning when it comes to comets because they're very unpredictable. Just ask anyone old enough to remember Kohoutek, the comet of the century. Well, or for that matter, anyone living above the equator when Halley's Comet made its appearance back in 1986. But who knows? Maybe we'll get lucky this time. Perhaps heading our list of current events on this date today would be the fact that another hurricane is barreling down on the Florida coast. Put a call into a longtime friend and someone who's been on this show on several occasions, who was living up till a couple days ago, south of Tampa, on the Gulf side of the Florida Peninsula. And when I called him up, he was, at that moment, in a car about 2 hours out of Miami, having packed all the food up out of his refrigerator, bought 4 days' worth of a hotel down in Miami, and vacated. As it stands right now, his house looks to be bullseyed by what is somewhere between a Category 3 and Category 5 hurricane, winds of, big winds, big storm surge. They said that they left, put all their furniture up on top of the tables, and hoped for the best. Whether he will have a house or boat when he gets home seems to be an open question at the moment, but we may get a report from Florida from him directly in the next week or two. And one thing that seems to be commonly talked about with this current spate of hurricanes is the fact that people are admitting, it looks as though these things are really getting ramped up by global warming. What do you know? Higher ocean temperatures, more moisture in the air, nastier hurricanes. This was predicted, of course, by James Hansen and other atmospheric scientists back in the 1980s. They predicted we would have more powerful storms, we would have more floods, we would also have more droughts, we would have more varied temperatures, and things would, in general, be going haywire. And, of course, the people like, for example, the current Republican candidates running for high office, Trump and Vance, to them this whole thing remains a hoax, which is why we're working so hard to do shows that will, outline a more reality-based look at what's going on. No, Mr. Miller and I don't think that Radio Parallax is going to swing this election.
You never know.
We have our hopes. Maybe someone listening in North Carolina or Georgia will be swayed from being an undecided voter to voting against the MAGA party ticket. Used to be called the Republican Party ticket, but that went by the board some time back. But it isn't just Florida where things are a little bit kablooey. Here in California, as we speak, we're in the middle of an unusual heat wave for October. The city of San Rafael, for example, and I had a temperature of 106
2 days ago.
Not only did this break the all-time record for the date for San Rafael, it broke it by 12 degrees. And for today's show, we're not even going to get into the matter of the Doomsday Glacier down in Antarctica.
Doomsdays usually aren't good news.
No, that's probably a good rule of thumb. Now, yours truly attended a high school reunion taking place over this past weekend. The city of Fremont, where yours truly attended high school, did not manage to climb up into the triple digits. But it was still pretty warm, and if you like these sorts of events, and I guess I do, they're always an interesting and surprising mix. I wound up talking to people that I don't really remember very well from high school. But one such person that I talked to, that I scarcely can remember, turned out to be just a really nice guy, and I enjoyed speaking with him. I also enjoyed another classmate who, like myself, left high school and went off to UC Davis. In the middle of speaking with him, a woman from the class ahead of mine came up to address the both of us and asked Mark if he was a swimmer. She had been a swimmer in her youth, and it was kind of a big deal for a certain subset of the population where I grew up. But I really enjoyed Mark's reply to the question, which was, "No, I sank." To which I had, "No, he wasn't a swimmer. He was our smartest guy." And he certainly might have been. We're having these reunions, it seems, every couple years, which, frankly, I don't think is a bad idea. I wish my medical school class would do get-togethers at more than five-year intervals. And, you know, a lot of the interactions were a lot of fun. One in particular, Linda Onstad in my class, mentioned that she'd heard about Radio Parallax at the last reunion, and in the meantime, she's taken up listening and enjoys it. To which I said, "God bless you, Linda." Which might have been an odd remark to make for an agnostic, but you get the idea. And because we get to do what we want on this program, I can thank Linda personally during the broadcast for her kind words. But I think the single most surreal moment from this event was noticing on the guest list. It was a list of people who were signed up and were coming, presumably. And there was a space for first name, last name, and a middle name, I guess, or maiden name. I was very amused at the entry that said, "Jeff Entertainment Meldahl." I assumed he was pranking the reunion committee with basically the sentiment that, yes, entertainment is my middle name. So I made a point to seek him out during the event, at which time he admitted, "No, they did that." Turns out he and Jim Cantor from my class were going to be the guitar players for a lengthy part of the evening, and so they were listed as entertainment. I was naturally a little bit disappointed because I thought it was Jeff being a wise guy and that I might have been the only one that caught it. But no. There was one person I ran into that I have a very, very clear memory of from high school, but I have not seen him, not laid eyes on him for the last 5 decades. So it was very weird to find yourself chatting with him and to observe the discontinuity between your memory and the person you're now speaking with. I would describe it as very time machine-y. And of course, very few people can pass from being age 17 and tacking on 5 decades and, still looking youthful. Some folks made a decent pass at it, others not so much. Now, a few minutes ago, Mr. Miller and I were going over some of the clips we're going to sort through for our second segment on today's program. And in one of them, we got to see the figure of Elon Musk jumping around like a puppy at a Donald Trump rally and telling the world what a great guy the Donald was. And of course, the Donald returned the favor as part of the mutual admiration society they both belong to. And now I've got friends that are planning to write people in the swing states to convince them to not be undecided and to vote for Harris. But it seems to me people residing in Silicon Valley might want to be aiming their target a little bit closer to home and directing it at people who work for Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, who's playing it very coy this go-around, saying he's going to be very apolitical. And yes, we still plan to talk a bit about what we can do in practical terms in the last few weeks rather than do our usual preaching to the choir. But having said that, I would say, choir, let's talk a little bit about Jill Stein. We have we've done our best to slam Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for a lot of very good reasons. We have heard the scuttlebutt, as no doubt you have also, dear listener, that RFK's wife, Cheryl Hines, is contemplating divorce. If it wasn't enough that he had jumped onto Team Trump, apparently the recent affair that he had with a reporter is putting her a bit over the edge. To which we say, Cheryl, you can do better. But let us go to the website put out by Russ Baker, with assistance from a friend of ours, Millicent Craner. An article written by Jonathan D. Simon. It's titled, Jill Stein, What the Hell Are You Doing? You can find the article at the website, whowhatwhy.org/politics. This is worth at least a minute of our time. And let's cut right to the chase. The statistics box accompanying the piece notes that in 2016, these were the following votes for Jill Stein. Jill took 1.07% of Michigan's vote. Trump's margin, 0.22%. Jill Stein took 1.04% of the Wisconsin vote. Trump's margin in Wisconsin was 0.77. And in Pennsylvania, Jill Stein took 0.81% of the vote, which Trump won by 0.72. You could certainly make the case, as does Jonathan Simon in the article, that had those votes for Jill Stein gone to Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump would not have been elected president. By the way, there are some that have taken a look at it and said that Donald Trump has never won a majority of the popular vote. He did not do so in 2016. He lost by 3 million to Hillary Clinton. He certainly did not do so in 2020 when he lost like by 8 million to Joe Biden. And my guess is that when the votes are counted here in 2024, he will again have failed to win the popular vote. But folks, that's not what counts. Now, we certainly do need third parties in this country. The Democrat and Republican Party are just, well, the Republican Party is no more. Although I think there still is a Republican Party of responsible Republicans, but they're not in the driver's seat right now for the electoral campaign. We would like to remind you that back in the year 2000, Ralph Nader got 22,000 votes in the state of New Hampshire. The state wound up going to Bush by 7,000 votes. So leaving Florida 2000 out of the equation, Al Gore would have been elected president had Ralph Nader not swung New Hampshire into the red column. And no, I'm not sure how many votes Nader got in Florida, but that was stolen by a variety of means, so we can't really blame Ralph for that one completely. He definitely got more than the 537 vote plurality that put the Florida in the Bush column. At any rate, the Who, What, Why article points out that although third-party candidates like to claim there's no difference between the two, well, there is. And right now, you know, you may have all the reservations in the world about Kamala Harris, and you're probably entitled to a few of them, but, noted Jonathan Simon in his letter to Jill Stein, let's get real. He said the election of Donald Trump would bring in large helpings just about everything you and I oppose, despise, and rightfully fear. An assault on personal rights and freedoms, more control of women's bodies, a drill, drill, drill turning back of environmental regs, the sale of vast swaths of federally protected land to favored corporate bidders, a truly insane tariff-dependent plan for the economy, mass deportations, internments at home, a further far-right Supreme Court, and some lower court domination that will outlive us, and of course, all the things that Project 2025 wants to do. I'm pretty darn sure that Jill Stein is not going to withdraw from the race. And worse, she's playing off the large Arab population in Michigan, claiming that the Biden-Harris administration could have a policy that was more favorable to the Palestinians. And by God, if they don't wake up and smell the coffee, then we shouldn't vote for Harris. This is not smart reasoning. Benjamin Netanyahu apparently is doing everything possible to ensure that Trump returns to the White House. So if you think that's going to be good for the Palestinian cause, well, you know, you must be smoking crack. All right, let us circle back to this upcoming movie, The Apprentice. Ms. Will and I are very keen to take this one in. Unlike the lame TV show that ran for 14 years where Trump was the guru and various people vied to be his apprentice, This film centers on the fact that Donald Trump was once the apprentice, and the guru was lawyer Roy Cohn. The one thing you can say about Roy Cohn is that he certainly cut quite a figure over the decades, from being a counsel to Joe McCarthy at the height of the Red Scare. He was instrumental in the prosecution of the so-called atomic spies, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, despite the fact that, in the end, they were pretty much penny ante spies. And it's possible Ethel was guilty of no more than feeding the other conspirators that were trying to steal atomic secrets. When Donald Trump and his old man were sued by the Department of Justice for racial discrimination in housing, something which they apparently were just caught dead to rights on, Trump sought out and hired Roy Cohn as his lawyer. We'll have some clips on that in a minute. But what I want to start with right now is the 1986 clip from Mike Wallace, who put some rather pointed questions to Roy Cohn late in Cohn's life. He was a sick man by this point. And what really stands out in the clip is Roy Cohn's ability to look you right in the eye and lie. Anyway, some of this exchange will speak for itself. Mr. McMillan?
I feel great.
Why? I mean, you were at death's door 6 months ago, 3 months ago.
I was shaving one morning and I felt a little bump. So I went, called the doctor, he said, come in. And he did a biopsy and they found I had liver cancer. And they found that, which spreads in strange directions, and I was treated for 3.5 weeks at the National Institute of Health and by Sloan Kettering here in New York. And the doctors tell me, I've strong faith in doctors now.
You're in remission?
I'm in total remission.
When I talk to friends and tell them that I am doing a profile of Roy Cohn, they say, ask him this, please. And I'm sure you know what they tell me to ask you. Do you have AIDS?
Oh, no. That's easy to answer.
The reason I ask is that in researching...
Is there that much public curiosity as to whether I had AIDS?
That is the question that everybody asks.
That's amazing. My doctors have gone on record as to exactly what I did have.
No, they haven't. They say it's a life-threatening disease, but the words liver cancer are not in their affidavits at all.
Well, if you want to get them, just call up Dr. Safai or Dr. Dick or any of them and you'll...
Dr. Sam Broder?
Sam Broder's fine.
We called them and they said that without Roy Cohn's permission, they couldn't talk to us. But we were told by other sources that Roy Cohn's name was on the NIH computer for AIDS.
Well, I shouldn't be. I'm glad you told me that. I'll get that taken care of very fast. Because I am in a division which AIDS is also in, but it's a cancer division. And the doctors who take care of me basically are cancer specialists. And the drug with which I was treated is an anti-cancer drug.
You know, of course, why people ask about AIDS and Roy Cohn.
Sure.
Because they believe that you're a homosexual and that you simply have never acknowledged the fact. And a good friend of mine, and a good friend of yours, I should say,
tell him if he wants to admit anything, he can, but it's a lie as far as I'm
concerned. No, a good friend of mine who is a woman says that she believes that Roy Cohn wants to, in effect, come out of the closet.
Come out of the closet, meaning make a very dramatic statement
just
about it.
Acknowledge that there's certainly nothing horrible about it.
We've been here, we've been doing a very intensive 20 minutes or more on me. I think you can see me, I think you can see and the audience can. I ain't dying from nothing to start with, number one.
Right.
Number two, you ask me categorically, and I tell you categorically, I do not have AIDS.
We should note that it was pretty well understood by the mid to late 80s that Roy Cohn had AIDS, but that he was telling the world that he had liver cancer. If he'd been a little more honest, he may have been able to advance the cause of gay rights, but as you will see in a minute, that was the last thing Roy Cohn ever had on his mind. Many years later, in 2019, a TV show on CUNY, which I presume is Columbia University of New York, hosted by Jim Zirin, brought on Roy's cousin. Well, he's a journalist, and he also happens to be Roy's cousin, named David L. Marcus, to talk about the viewpoint that, well, perhaps Roy Cohn is running the show out of the Oval Office, even though he's no longer here with us. The program was called Conversations, and we should point out that it came out before the COVID fiasco. At any rate, here's David Marcus talking to James Zirin.
Well, you think about the first meeting they had. This, in a lot of ways, casts a die for what we're seeing today in Washington, what we're seeing writ large in the world. Cohn and Trump bumped into each other, and Trump said, hey, I have this problem.
It was in a bar, wasn't it?
It was in a place called Lee Club. It was sort of where people went to be seen, and it was in Manhattan, and they were both preening like peacocks. But Roy had the center of attention. Trump was not well known. He was young. And Trump said, you know, I've heard about you. I've talked to all these lawyers, and the Department of Justice is going after me because they say, correctly, that I'm not letting African Americans, I'm not letting blacks in the apartment complexes I own in Queens and Brooklyn. And Roy said, forget these establishment lawyers. Don't make a deal with them. Go after them. And that started a conversation which resulted in Trump, who was guilty, suing the federal government for $100 million. Now, he ultimately did not win that suit, but that's a lesson from Roy. You deflect attention, you dodge, you divert. When you're attacked, you counterattack. And you always find somebody to blame. Those three things, we see that now. That was the 70s. We see that now in, you know, years later, decades later.
And Cohn called a press conference with Trump, and they told the reporters all about the lawsuit and why they'd counterclaimed and their version of the case.
So you think about that. Using the media, or now social media, to distract attention. I wonder where that came from.
Came vintage Roy Cohn.
His playbook is probably on every desk in the White House. I mean, virtually. I'm not saying there's a real one, but that was Roy. Don't admit you're wrong. Don't admit you're guilty. Attack other people. Go after scapegoats if you can find Mexican immigrants or in these days, or homosexuals in the government. Now, it's important. A lot of your younger viewers don't know. People committed suicide because Roy went in. This is a serious business. People in Washington who were outed as gay in the 1950s committed suicide. I would say that Trump is going after people and ruining lives too. By the way, Roy had $3 million of IRS liens on him when he died. He didn't pay his taxes. He was audited for 20 plus years. Is any of this sounding familiar at all?
Sounds quite familiar. Now, the race discrimination case, that was their first relationship, an attorney-client relationship. Nothing much happened in the case for about 5 years. And at the end of the day, how was the case resolved?
Well, the thing is, Trump ultimately was guilty of it. And Trump was not exonerated, as he claims. But it didn't matter because Trump realized what Roy Cohn told him, that the court of public opinion is more important than a court of law in some places. So Trump became known as a fighter, as a tough guy, even though he was completely guilty of discrimination. This is the 1950s when this was becoming an issue. But what stuck with people was Trump was the guy who would go after people just with Roy at his back.
So one of the Roy Cohn precepts from the playbook was, no matter what happens to you, declare victory and go home.
Exactly. And that's, you know, you and I could have a whole other conversation about that. Worked in New York politics, that worked in Chicago, that worked in Boston, that worked in cities for a long time. Pay off somebody, scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. The Favor Bank. He was an expert at the Favor Bank. But I wonder, I've really been wondering about this. In Washington, there's a whole establishment of intelligence people and people who work for Democrats and governments and Democrats and Republicans, and they're going to be there long after you, the president, are there.
So-called deep state.
But he calls it deep state, but it's not. It's civil servants who actually care about functioning government. They're not political people. And I actually think that Trump thought the Roy Cohn lessons that worked so well in New York, he thought would work on the global stage, would work in Washington. But as you and I are watching headlines today, I'm not sure that that's it translates to D.C. For the political stuff that people care about, he never, ever, ever showed remorse. And that, to me, is shocking because a lot of things he did were wrong. Going after people in government and saying they're gay, come on. He said that they were more likely to commit treason, espionage, because they were gay and they could be outed or whatever it was. Here was a guy who could have been outed. He said that. Going after the Rosenbergs, especially Ethel, heinous, disgusting. But he did admit in joking ways to me that I knew he was gay. He knew he was gay. I don't care about that. But when you're
well,
gay...
Well, yeah, he did say, I'm not gay. I just like to have sex with men. He was quoted as saying that.
He said similar things to me. But and I don't care about that. I wouldn't care about that. But when you're gay and you're going after gay people, that's despicable.
That's the hypocrisy.
He was the ultimate, ultimate hypocrite until, fast forward, we have Rudy Giuliani, Trump, Barr. These people, are they truly patriots? Roy always said he was a patriot. Roy is buried in a crypt that says lawyer and patriot. He was disbarred and he went after his own country. A patriot is somebody who cares about his country or her country despite politics, above politics. Roy didn't do that, and I would say these gentlemen, people, are not doing that.
You remember there was a bill in the city council which would have afforded gays equal rights and shielded them from discrimination in public accommodation, and he used all of his political influence to block that bill for years.
That bill, had it passed, could have sent a message to the country, to the world, that you can be who you are and we accept you. Just be a taxpaying good person and it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is. But Roy stymied it.
All right, we want to point out that that we, along with David Marcus, are not trying to beat up on Roy Cohn for being gay. What we're trying to beat up on him for is being so hypocritical. Anyway, in reference to that bill that didn't get passed in New York back in the 1980s, the Nicholas von Hoffman bio of Roy Cohn, titled Citizen Cohn, refers to how Roy actually would show up and give public speeches denouncing this this gay rights issue, after which he would head back to the limo and climb in with his $500 a day male escort and drive away. And David Marcus and Tony Schwartz make an appearance in the frontline discussion of The Choice, which came out 2 weeks ago on PBS. Let's hear a minute of that, Mr. McMillan.
When they met, Roy said to him, "You might be guilty, it doesn't matter. Go after the Justice Department. Don't ever admit guilt.
Fight it, you'll kill them. Just deny everything and fight." And Trump was totally taken by that, and he hired Roy Cohn as his lawyer.
That was a defining moment for Donald Trump. Donald Trump was on the ropes. There was no doubt they had discriminated. There was no doubt there was wrongdoing. And yet, Roy Cohn showed him that you can turn around a situation just by ignoring the facts and going after your attacker. Trump countersued the Justice Department for $100 million.
"I have never, nor has anyone in our organization ever, to the best of my knowledge, discriminated or shown bias in renting our apartments."
This is a classic example of where Trump begins to demonstrate something he talks about all the time today, which is he's a counterpuncher. So somebody comes out after him and says that he's done something nefarious and horrible, and he just goes back at them with all guns blazing. You know, boom, boom, boom. And admits nothing, never admit anything, never say you made a mistake, just keep coming.
His countersuit didn't work, and in fact, he did end up quietly settling out of court. But Roy went on the offensive and said, "This is a victory. Trump was vindicated." He knew before anybody else did that the court of public opinion is often more important than a court of law. The lesson from Roy Cohn was, don't go the way the establishment does. Don't play by the rules.
Anyway, that last voice was Tony Schwartz, the author of Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. And dear listener, if you've never heard Tony Schwartz's description of what went into putting that book together, I suggest that you look it up sometime. It's rather amusing. What they're talking about here, Trump never admitting that he's wrong, always going on the attack, is something we just saw in that debate with Kamala Harris. She showed great insight in going after him personally, knowing that he would be unable to resist going on the attack, even if his punches were wild. And as we close the segment, we should note that the issue of COVID remains something the Democrats are not taking advantage of. And we don't know why. Donald Trump's idiotic decisions during the COVID crisis killed quite literally hundreds of thousands of Americans. We refer you to the timeline we put together on the website TrumpPandemic.net, because sadly it's all still relevant. John Oliver did a great takedown of Donald Trump several years back on his ham-fisted mismanagement of COVID. And if we had some more time, we would play that for you. But we'll get it to in a future installment of the show, probably when we have Stephen Harper back. Now, we here at the Radio Parallax are appalled by the idea of ham-fisted mismanagement, and we don't want to do that with our time, so we need to take a break. So let's do that. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.